Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Among the immortals, Leonardo, Rembrandt, Picasso, Michelangelo stands alone as a master of painting, sculpture, and architecture. He was not only one of the greatest artists in an age of giants, but a man who reinvented the practice of art itself. Throughout his long career, he clashed with patrons by insisting that he had no master but his own demanding muse. Journalist and historian Miles Unger inspects his life through six iconic works in his new book, Michelangelo, A Life in Six Masterpieces. We welcome Miles Unger to the roundtable this morning.
It's a pleasure.
What brought you to the life of Michelangelo and specifically to look at that life in six masterpieces?
Well, I can answer the first question easily enough. I lived for 5 years in Florence and have a deep and abiding affection for the place and the culture. So it was natural for me to want to write about a place that has such a rich, a vibrant history and is such an important part of Western culture. This is actually my third book on the Florentine Renaissance. I sort of think of it as my Florentine trilogy. I began with a biography of Lorenzo de' Medici, known as Lorenzo the Magnificent, then of Machiavelli, the great political philosopher, and Michelangelo seemed like, you know, the next great monument to conquer. And these are all figures who knew each other and sort of traveled in the same social, political, and cultural circles. And as you sort of research the life of one, you inevitably get more and more curious about the life of the other. And this was a project particularly dear to me. I began my sort of career writing about art, and Michelangelo was always, you know, one of the great giants of the Western tradition, always seemed like a wonderful subject for a book, wonderfully interesting and intense character, had a long and interesting life, so it seemed like a great topic to tackle. As far as why I chose to write about his life in six masterpieces, this is, as I said, my third biography, and one of the difficulties of writing about somebody whose life is led primarily in the mind, you know, an artist or a writer, even a philosopher, is you tend to either write a narrative biography in which you talk about the main incidents in a person's life and you know, his loves and his trials and tribulations, his professional disappointments or whatever, but you tend in that kind of narrative to give short shrift to the work. It's hard to interrupt a narrative of a life, you know, and give, you know, page after page after page of sort of critical description. It sort of interrupts the flow. So I thought this was a way, I didn't want to lose the work, which is after all why we, you know, come to Michelangelo, is because we're, you know, so amazed and astounded by the work. I didn't want to lose that, but I also didn't want to lose the narrative of a life that was incredibly interesting and filled with incident. So I wanted to somehow combine the best of both worlds. I mean, I thought this was a good way to do it, by taking life, building it around the great works that he created over the course of a long career.
And chronological?
They are chronological, and I managed, I think, to find, you know, a good balance between sort of find works that were, I think, you know, sort of the most significant works that he created, but they sort of conveniently filled up the, you know, from the beginning of his life to the end. So it worked out very well. And in fact, I'd originally titled the book Michelangelo, A Life in Five Masterpieces, but then I found myself with two problems. One was the last 20 or so years of his life, yet I had no way of writing that in that format. And also I hadn't really dealt with his crucial work in architecture. So I decided that I would include his work on St. Peter's, which took up the last 20 years of his life and sort of revolutionized the course of architecture as well. So I ended up, didn't have to work out perfectly, but I think in the end it did.
You end with, as you mentioned, the Basilica of St. Peter's. You begin with the Pietà. As that as a starting point, what does that tell us about him as an artist, and what would ultimately become his artistic career?
Well, one of the things it indicates is that in Michelangelo's time, the church remains one of the vital patrons of art, the Catholic Church in particular. He worked for, I think, nine different popes throughout his life. The Guetta was not commissioned by a pope. It was commissioned by an important cardinal, a French cardinal. Michelangelo himself was a deeply religious man in his own idiosyncratic way. And much of his art is religious art to one extent or another. You know, the Pietà, St. Peter's, which he says he dedicates to God. He said he didn't take a salary to work on St. Peter's because it was his way of dedicating his life to God. You know, the Sistine Ceiling and the Last Judgment are also works commissioned by the church. The one major work that has sort of no connection to that I talk about, that has no specific connection to the church, was the David, which was a work commissioned by the Florentine government. At the time, the government was threatened from forces, belligerent forces, and they wanted a great patriotic symbol. And Michelangelo creates this wonderful sort of heroic figure, the symbol of the underdog Florentines fighting off their foes. But even the David is, to some extent, a religious figure, a biblical figure, even though Michelangelo and the people who commissioned it very much saw it as a work of civic pride and a patriotic work. So I think that you can see through, one of the themes that runs throughout Michelangelo's life, and indeed the life of any art of his contemporaries, would be the extent to which art revolved and was commissioned by religious figures and institutions. But I think in a way that one of the things that Michelangelo does is, even though, and you can see this in the early Pietà, is that even though it's a deeply religious work, it's incredibly moving and poignant, and people still flock to it and are brought to tears by it when they see it, but it's in a way also very much outside the tradition of religious art, in that it declares itself immediately as a work of art, rather than a work of, like an icon, which is supposed to have miraculous powers. Michelangelo even signed it very brazenly across the blouse of the Virgin Mary, his own signature, sort of proclaiming his authorship, which is a very different kind of thing than artists used to, that did before him, which was sort of, you know, the work had to be anonymous. That had, you know, there are all these legends of you know, icons being actually painted by angels or painted by the saints or by the Virgin Mary themselves, and the artist who actually painted it was sort of an anonymous figure. Michelangelo, even in his most religious works, declares his authorship and his own point of view, and he says, you know, look at me, I am the creator of this, and any magic or miracle that comes out of this it belongs to me, and I deserve the credit for it. So there is a sort of weird tension there between the kind of needs of religion and the demand of the artist whose fame rests upon his amazing achievement in sculpture and in painting.
Was he always interested in all three, sculpting, painting, and architecture? Were they always overlapping, or did you see an evolution from sculpture to painting to architecture?
Well, Michelangelo loved to say about everything that wasn't sculpture, this is not my art. This is the phrase that's constantly coming up when somebody's demanding of him something he doesn't want to do, like the Sistine Chapel. He didn't want to paint it, and he tells the Pope, Pope Julius at the time, he says, this is not my art, as a way of sort of wriggling free of the obligation. So he sees himself as a sculptor first and foremost. He signs his letters, Michelangelo Sculptor, even when he's in the midst of painting. So he begins as a sculptor. This is his first passion. But artists were expected to be sort of jacks of all trade. He trained in the studio of the most successful fresco painter of his age, Ghirlandaio. Just simply the demands of commissions that came from both his own government and from the Pope sort of forced him, and you know, he sort of had to be dragged kicking and screaming to the great paintings that he did, particularly the Sistine Ceiling and the Last Judgment. So there's definitely, he begins as a sculptor. His first works are sculptures, particularly stone carving. He did not like modeling in clay, which he felt was basically a form of painting because it was additive. It was done by building up, either through pigment or in the case of modeled sculpture of clay. He thinks of stone, he thought of himself as a stone carver. But then, of course, he's required to do these paintings that become famous for, you know, perhaps the most famous painting in the history of art, you know, the Sistine Chapel. And he takes architecture rather late in life as his physical powers are diminishing. He didn't have the physical energy anymore to carry on these big art fresco cycles or sculptures. And architecture was something that was done in the mind. It was something that it was considered a respectable profession for a gentleman and a scholar. Late in life, architecture begins to dominate his artistic production, particularly the last 20 years of his life, where he really almost gives up painting and sculpture in favor of working on St. Peter's Basilica. So there is an evolution, and there is also, I think he sort of begins to see himself less as a craftsman and more as a kind of gentleman and scholar. So I think architecture fits in more with his own self-conception as an older man, somebody who's sort of given up the sort of manual labor of art in favor of this more scholarly pursuit, you know, something that you can do in your library, you know, with a protractor and a ruler, rather than sort of getting grimy and, you know, your hair filled with dust and, you know, your eyes filled with paint. So it's a much more sort of cerebral and scholarly pursuit.
Unlike many artists certainly famous artists and the artists that we think of as the greats, what struck me interesting about the story that you tell is that during his lifetime that this cult of personality grew up around him. He was very aware of how his work was being received, as was the public aware of what he was doing.
Well, I think I've described Michelangelo at some point in the book as sort of the first modern artist, and some people find this a very strange statement. I mean, in many ways, he's sort of the great Renaissance artist, you know, heir to the great tradition of Donatello and Leonardo and Masaccio, and the sort of great craftsmen of the past, and he certainly is a consummate craftsman. But he's really the first artist who insists that the artist's personality, his own sort of idiosyncratic vision, is a crucial part of the artwork itself. I mean, in a way that I don't think you see with his contemporaries, particularly Raphael or Titian, you don't feel the personality coming through in the way you do with many of Michelangelo's greatest works. I mean, you really feel that this kind of gargantuan, sort of egotistical, tormented soul is really coming through his greatest works. If you think of the Moses, or if you think of the figure of God in the Sistine Chapel, or those tormented captives struggling to break free, Michelangelo was the first really to create this notion that art was a kind of self-expression. And for this reason, who he was as a person is such a crucial part to understanding the works themselves. They sort of demand, when you look at the work, you sort of see the artist coming through. I think this is one of the reasons why he never worked with a team, that he always worked almost completely alone, is because he really wanted to stamp his own personality, his own vision on the work. And this, of course, the fact that you could see so much of him in the work meant that people were very interested in who he was as a person. And he did tend to cultivate his own image. He had his own biographers. And when one biographer didn't please him, he had somebody else write something else, which he thought corrected the record. So he was not only did he need to express himself, but he was very careful about shaping his own image, even if he had to shade or distort the facts of his own life to do it. I mean, he famously sort of rewrote parts of his biography in order to make himself to tell the story he wanted to tell, rather than one that conformed with the facts.
Well, the name of the book is Michelangelo, A Life in Six Masterpieces. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Miles Younger, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you very much for sharing with us. Again, the title of the book, Michelangelo, A Life in Six Masterpieces. It's published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.